Rachel just told me they're doing construction next door, so if you hear like sawing and stuff like that. We just did a meditation retreat up at Mount Lemmon. We rented a little cabin, and what was it, like on our second session, all of a sudden these guys come with chainsaws and start cutting down trees. We're like, so tonight I want to talk about this idea that like breeds like. And I was with a friend this morning, and she was trying to use my cell phone. Have you ever tried to use somebody else's cell phone? You know, it's like rocket science, right? Because you're like, what button? You're like the little back arrow space bar. They're like, I don't know what that is on this phone. But her reaction was one of like, I'm such an idiot. I'm never, you know, I'm like, and I could feel the power of her being diminished. You know what I mean? And we tend to think that it's okay to be judgmental about ourselves, but that it's a bad quality to be judgmental about others. And we actually, I think, in this culture, think it's almost a positive thing to be judgmental about ourselves. Like to beat ourselves up, like I'm such a bad person. And but if you look throughout the scripture and throughout the spiritual teachings, it's this idea that like breeds like. So judgment is only going to breed judgment. Judgment towards yourself will only breed judgment towards other people. And the thing about judgment or anger or negativity is it's an uncomfortable place to live. You know, nobody wakes up in the morning feeling like good or neutral or just, you know, feeling fine. And you don't wake up and you think like, I'm going to try to be as judgmental as I can today. You know, like, I'm just going to judge even people I like. And you know, you wake up and there's a mailman, you think like, he's dressed so ugly. Or, you know, it's not a quality that you cultivate, right? And we try to cultivate the other qualities. Like, we try to think like, I'm going to try to be nice today, which doesn't last very long either, right? But this idea of judgmentalness, it breeds further judgmentalness. And I think that one of the root places to start is with ourselves, because it's so easy for us to have this kind of... what I was trying to get at in the meditation is to try to find a quality where you can back up a little bit and watch how your mind cycles. Just watch how you start to... be judgmental about yourself for being judgmental about yourself. All right, is everybody catching me? You can like, one of the things that can happen in that meditation is you can like figure out something you're shameful about or something you feel judgmental about yourself, and then you step back a little bit and you can just do it again. You can be like, man, I can't believe how judgmental I am about myself. Like, I really need to stop doing that. That's a bad, bad thing. Right, you know? It's sick. It's just this, it's a very, 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 very subtle cycle that we're all stuck in. And what I was trying to get us to do was to watch ourselves with the same kind of equanimity that we would just think about our mailbox. Unless you have some, like, unless you really love your mailbox, you know? Unless you, like, handcrafted it out of popsicle sticks or something. But, you know, most of it's something we feel neutral about. Just to watch, right? Watch how the mind works. To allow a little spaciousness there. Because there's a power to just watching what's happening. So last week we talked about Lila. And I want to go a little bit into that again today. What's Lila?
Fun,
that's a great way to think about it. It's kind of fun, yeah. But Lila is...
holy playfulness.
Yeah, beautiful. Barbie said holy playfulness. I think of that movie, At Play in the Fields of the Lord. Right? It's just to... And you see this with the saints. The saints, whatever tradition, whether you're looking at Buddhist or Christian or, you know, Baal Shem Tov of Judaism, the saints all have this quality of playfulness. And it's not because they don't see suffering. In fact, most of the saints around us see more suffering than we do. Think about Desmond Tutu. His job is to sit there and listen to the people's atrocities that they went through during the apartheid in South Africa. He has to hear over and over how people were forced to watch their loved ones be tortured. You know, this is his job. Same with His Holiness the Dalai Lama. That's their job, to witness this. And yet they're totally playful. They're totally joyful. So the question that we're playing with over the next couple weeks, and the past couple of weeks is, how can we get to that place? Because it doesn't have to do with removing suffering in our life. The suffering is there, right? It has to do with an attitude we have towards the suffering. So, we looked at this quote last week by Yogi Ram Sarath Kumar, right? A Hindu saint. And he says, again, he calls himself the beggar. So when he says the beggar, he's referring to himself. He says, it is this beggar's play, his lila, not work, right? He's saying it's a playfulness, not work. When there's activity which is motivated by self-interest and ends with pleasure or pain, we may call it work. It requires exertion. But when we live outside the reach of pleasure or pain, a realized man is untouched by these. Our activities are effortless. Our work is really our play. I'm going to break that down for a second. But the first point we have to realize is that there is a place that we can get to where effort turns into playfulness. When I, you know, sometimes at my job, it takes effort to be there, right? So we're talking about holy laziness. We're talking about exerting less effort and doing just as much good in the world. So how can we get there? He says, our work is really our play. And it's an obscuration that confuses it for work. So what are the two clues? He gives us two clues here. There it goes. One of the clues is he says, let's see, when there's activity which is motivated by self-interest. Right? Again, if we want to take something that's naturally playful and make it work, we just infuse it with a dose of self-interest. Make it more and more about you, and it will become more and more work. That's fascinating. I mean, we could spend the rest of the year just repeating that. We really could. It's an unbelievable concept. If you want to take something that is naturally joyful and make it work and painful, just infuse it with self-interest. And how much of our day is infused with self-interest on some level? Right? It's fascinating. So that's the first clue, right? Is we could say a kind of selflessness. If we can somehow apply a kind of selflessness to our daily work, right? The next clue he gives us is a little more subtle, but he says, but when we live outside the reach of pleasure or pain, a realized man or woman is untouched by these, right? When we live outside the reach of pleasure or pain, meaning when we exert ourselves in an activity and are not concerned about whether it becomes a pleasurable or a painful activity. So, one way I think about this is minimize expectations. Now, what does this mean? What does it mean to minimize expectations? I'm reading a beautiful book I highly recommend called A Man to Match His Mountains. It's about Badshah Khan, who's one of the greatest nonviolent Muslim leaders of modern history. And he was the Muslim equivalent to Gandhi. They were fighting at the same time for nonviolence. And it's an extraordinary story. And he's, you know, his brothers and his family are all murdered, you know, constantly by the British, who control, at that point, North India, right? And there's a non-violent protest against the British. In the south, it's being headed by Gandhi, and in the north, it's being headed by Bashar Khan. And as I'm reading, I'm thinking, I don't believe in non-violence as much as he does. Like, I would break at a certain point, you know? Like, the British come in, and they just say, take off your non-violent patches. You know, they have these non-violent patches. And they refuse to do it. And the British soldier shoots the person, you know, and he goes to the next person. He says, take off your patch. And the guy refuses to, and he just shoots him. I don't believe in non-violence. I would take the patch off. You know what I mean? But the belief is that just by that act of non-violence, you are serving, in a sense, you are serving the person that's trying to fight you. Because what's the other option? Is to fight back. And as I was reading this, I could feel the anger surge up in my body. And I would fight back. And I would shoot that, you know, I would steal a gun and I would shoot that person. Because it's sick what they're doing. But then what would I be doing? I would just, you know, like breeds like, right? So it's a strong belief that the way to stop violence in the world is to act nonviolently. Now, I'm not asking you to believe in that, but I'm just saying that that's a strong belief system, right? And as I was reading this, I was thinking, how could Bashar Khan, as it seemed like nonviolence was failing, right? The British weren't leaving the country. And I didn't realize until I read this that Gandhi's fight against the British didn't take like a year or 2 years. It took years, right? And still, he was unrelenting in his belief in nonviolence. Which doesn't mean passivity. It means standing up against injustice. So as I was reading this, I was like, how is it possible to really hold the line? You know, how is it possible to hold the line when it seems like it's failing? Because more and more thousands of people were just getting slaughtered, you know. The British would come into a whole town, surround the town, and just murder every single person in the town. I would break at that point, right? Because my actions are based on the result of my actions. It's a subtle point. It's a very subtle point. It's a very deep point. Is it possible to act without being attached to the results of your actions? And that's what this has to do with. Minimize expectations to what the outcome of your actions will be. I'll say that again. Minimize expectations to what the result of your actions will be. Which means that if it ends in pleasure or pain, it's no big deal. Right? It's still lila. It's still divine play. Because you know that the foundation of your work is solid. Right? The foundation of Bashar Khan's work was about love and humanity. It was the opposites of violence and hatred. And that he was unshakable about. He had a strong belief that love was more powerful than hatred. Boom, period. That's it. Therefore, his actions are rooted in that. That's all. That's simple. Therefore, whatever happens as a result of his actions of trying to cultivate love doesn't matter. You see? Very interesting. Whatever happens as a result of his actions, as long as his actions are rooted in a foundation of love, it doesn't matter what happens. Therefore, there's no hopelessness. What I'm overcome with is hopelessness. I see I'm overwhelmed by the suffering in the world, you know, or even by my own actions, and I'm always trying to figure out how to do this or that, and then that seems to cause more problems, and I'm like, oh, you know, because I'm saturated in self-interest, and I'm saturated in a grasping towards the results of my actions. Again, what are we talking about? We're just talking about how to have more fun in a painful, suffering existence. But not just more fun, how to be more joyful in our effort. How to be more joyful in the world, which equates as how to eradicate depression. It equates as how to eradicate depression, how to eradicate self-loathing, right? How to have joyful effort, divine lila, divine effort. So two things here, right? Selflessness and minimize expectations. Anybody have any comments or is anybody confused yet? Does it make sense? Do you see what I'm saying so far? Just as an intellectual endeavor, consider. So there's one more I want to look at. And we have this quote from Lee Lazarwick, which we read last time. And listen for it, because the key to number three is in this quote, right? He says, the work, and what's the work? It's the spiritual life. Who's going to yoga after this? One. Okay, I'll let you know, but feel free to get up. You got 10 minutes.
Perfect.
All right. He says the work. What we're talking about is spiritual work. To sit down and meditate requires work. You guys are all brave to come in here, especially if those of you that haven't meditated. Like, rejoice for a moment. It takes work to watch the mind, as you noticed, right? The mind flies off. We're talking about effort. It takes work. How to turn that into joyfulness.
Lee Lazowick says this, the work wants your life, but only when you are in a love affair with life itself. Only when you are bright, strong, confident, capable. In short, only when you are alive. The work does not want some kind of dull, dispassionate, struggling, agonizing humanoid. To give your life to the work is to give breath and activity to the work every day. To give passion to the work every day. You have to have a childlike, eternal beginner's mind, a belief in miracles, like any day, anything can happen. It is the nature of this work that a revelation, a breakthrough, could happen at any time, and has many times. But how quickly we forget. All right, based on that quote, what's number three? It's like Jeopardy. Wouldn't that be amazing if Jeopardy was like that? You know, like 2 million people across America were like, oh, what is it? What is the key to... What do you think? Based on that quote, what is it?
A spiritual practice.
A spiritual practice, Barb says.
Innocence.
Beginner's mind. Yeah, in a sense, all three of you have it. I label it as beginner's mind. So this is what we talked about last week. The three components.
And what do you mean by beginner's mind?
Yeah, it's a great question. So let's look at it. Well, here's the big question. How does beginner's mind, right? How does it relate to a belief in miracles? Because do you remember, that's also what he says. You have to have a childlike, eternal beginner's mind, a belief in miracles, like any day, anything can happen. Okay?
Childlike mind.
Yeah. Open. Yeah, an open mind, right? How would believing in miracles, for an example, create an open mind, which would then create more joyfulness in our activities, in our effort? How are those related? What do miracles and an open mind have to do with each other? Yeah.
We are conditioned to spend our lives looking at everything as normal.
Yeah.
What happened today is pretty much like what happened yesterday.
Yeah.
Maybe a little better, maybe a little worse.
Yeah.
But it's a continuum of stuff.
Yeah.
It's not miraculous.
Yeah, I mean, we see the world as non-miraculous, you know. Even when I've noticed recently, even when totally miraculous things happen, I just think of it as normal. For example, I was helping a friend put up a mosquito net, and we needed a screw, you know, like a hook screw to go in the ceiling. And I looked down in the carpet, and there was one hiding in the carpet. Right? And this is his house. And I said, oh, here's what we need. And I put it up there. He's like, where did you get that? That's in your carpet. He's like, that's never been in this room, you know? And I was like, yeah, whatever. And, you know, for him, that was like, he was able to see the miracle, and I was just experiencing things as ordinary, right? Do you remember that line from Alice in Wonderland? Alice is talking to the Queen. And remember, Alice is quite rational. Alice is us, right? And Alice said, Alice laughed. There's no use trying, she said. One can't believe in impossible things. I dare say you haven't had much practice, said the Queen. When I was younger, I always did it for half an hour a day. Why, sometimes I believed as many as 6 impossible things before breakfast. Right? It's just like, it's a practice of being able to see the miracle. The miracle is evident. I mean, the miracle of our existence is all around us. And I just want to end with, we're on page 2 of my 6-page discussion. So I'm going to pull it to an end. I want to suggest something, that if anybody in here has done relatively long retreats, you notice something. I noticed something, and that there is a deep grief that comes in on all of the ways we've missed being with each other. And the only way I could, it's a bad analogy, but I was just trying to think of an analogy, and it's like we're kids in an ice cream shop, right? And we're obsessed with the dust blowing into the store. So we're just trying to sweep the dust out, you know? And the dust is all of our, like, little petty problems, our judgmentalness, our jealousies, right? Just all the little ways, the little mind, right? They call it the little mind. And we're just trying to sweep it out. And then before you know it, the ice cream store is closed, you know? And the guy's like, you got to get out. And you're like, but I never got any ice cream, you know? And the ice cream is the miracle of us just being together. The ice cream is even the miracle of being in a bad mood. The miracle of even being grumpy. The miracle of our hearts beating. The miracle of a connection with another people. We're surrounded by miracles, but we're obsessed with the kind of dust. And when you're face to face with your death, when you're about to be plucked from this life, I have a feeling the emotion that will be is a kind of regret that the small mind kept you so much from the miracle of being with each other. It's just, you know, and as much as you can, like, fight against that, because it is so painful when you stop long enough to feel it. Like in long retreats, that grief has hit me so heavily. Like, it's just this grief that my small-mindedness kept me from the miracle of interacting with people. That kept me from the miracle of being together. And don't wait for the last minute to, like, for the ice cream shop to close, you know? Enjoy it now. We're talking about trying to just awaken to the miracle. And one of the keys to that is a mindfulness practice, some type of meditation practice, because eventually you can get to that place of feel that. I mean, maybe in company it might be hard, but when you're alone, try to really get into that shame, the meditation, right? Try to really feel the places that you really hold shame, really hold judgment. That's like just the dust blowing into the ice cream shop. It's just limiting you. So the more we can actually feel that and then just lovingly embrace it. There, again, like breeds like. The more we can embrace ourselves and all of our faults, right? The more we can embrace other people and their faults. And I want to suggest that the watch the mind throughout the day. The level of your judgmentalness towards other people is just a level of the reflection of your judgmentalness towards yourself. So if most of the day is spent with annoying people, I want to suggest that it's just because you're a little bit too harsh with yourself. And when you look at the saints, if you have the pleasure of being around a saint, they're so lovingly accepting of you, regardless of your size, of your abilities, you know? And that's why people are attracted to them. That's why they're always trying to run away from us, because they're overwhelmed by, like, the attraction. Everybody's trying to crowd in around them, because we love that feeling of being accepted. We love that feeling of being loved, you know? And that can come from, it can start with ourselves, and it can start with something as simple as a daily meditation practice. Sounds strange, right? But that's the only place it starts. With starting to become aware, mindful of what's actually happening. So let's finish it there. And next week we'll just finish. And those of you that have been here for weeks and weeks, we're actually coming back. We're making a full circle to a conversation we haven't finished yet. It just got more complex, but we're coming back to the four approaches to the wanting mind. Do you remember that? We looked at mindfulness, analyzing, realization of emptiness, and then transubstantiation. So fear not, we're coming back. I haven't forgotten. Next week we're going to talk a little bit about divining. You know, a friend of mine has property and he's actually hired a diviner. Interesting name for it, right? To find the water. My friend John Sheedy, and he's hired a diviner. So what we're going to talk about next week is divining what our real desire is. Just looking at that, divining our real desire. So thank you so much. My real desire right now is for raisin and pecan dark chocolate. And because I'm going to try to utilize this and apply some selflessness, and maybe that's all I'm going to apply from that list, I'm going to share it with you all. So please have some chocolate. Thanks to Vicky who brought it.
Thank you, Will.
Yeah. Good luck.
Thank you.
We're all counting
you
on
always
you.
Always bring us chocolate.
Yeah.